Good afternoon. It is Thursday afternoon of February 18th, 3 o'clock. We're doing Chem 12B, and now I'm done with all the entry stuff. We're going to, I think I was going to steal some time today to do some more problem solving stuff. And apparently I was doing the co-op problems instead of the practice problems I wanted to do the other day. No harm, no foul. It's all good. And I don't know if the rest of the problems are still co-op problems, but I'm just going to continue on the same thing that I did this morning. So we'll steal some time out of that as I'm still trying to get some of the lab stuff up. But yeah, let's go ahead and start that. Let me start a screen share. So I had a list of problems that I did this morning. I figured I would do the same ones. If we can go faster, if they seem beneath your current level, let me know. We'll pick it up. And that's what I was going to do, JC, was pick up on page 2 and pick up in those problems. So that's a good thing. And I have a, what they call a hard out. I got to be out of here at 4:15. And so as we get close to that 4:15 time, I'll wind down and then we'll have a shorter day today, which is fine since we're doing review stuff anyway. Okay, first problem I want to work on. I was going to start on 6, but maybe if you guys are having trouble on the second page, maybe just starting on the second page, getting some of the stuff that we went through. Let me start actually on number 8. It's the last one on the first page. There's some things about number 8. Which you kind of need to see to understand. I'm wanting to back up even further. I'm wanting to start like around 6 and 7, but I feel 6 and 7 at this point might be too slow. Let's start with 8. We'll see where we're at. We'll see how we're doing. Okay, so when we take this back and we start thinking about a retrosynthesis, let's first start with mapping before we get too far. And I like to look for that handle. I like to get a handle on the problem. And so I look for something in here that can be a handle for this problem. And in that regard, what I see is I see the isopropyl group. And the isopropyl group, if we label it 1, 2, 3, and 4, 1, 2, 3, and 4, the isopropyl group sort of guides us in what's going to happen here. And that means, and I need to keep numbering this one out, 5 and 6. 5 and 6 are new. And that means that I'm probably going to want to cleave between 4 and 5 on this molecule in terms of breaking it down. And again, that's because that substrate is reflected all the way in the carbons 1 through 4. And so what I'll do in breaking that apart is I'll take it to the synthons. And this gives us an opportunity to really revisit this synthon idea. Okay, in looking at the synthons, the right-hand side is not difficult. The right-hand side really is just the acetylide anion. But the left-hand side has some options in trying to figure out what we want to do with that left-hand side. And what I consider to be one of the options that most people would choose is most people would say, well, why don't I just put a bromide there? And in fact, maybe I'll put it over here. And maybe that question mark should go with this. So the synthons are up above. And from the synthons, what we get is we get what are called synthetic equivalents or synthetic, not synthetic targets.
Progenitors?
No, there was something else I called them. I had a name for them. Shoot. And I'm in the wrong lecture too. I mean, OCAM instead of lab notes. Okay, this note needs to move. Come with me over to lab notes. Now I'm totally lost. That was so successful, Jason. Okay. And what did I call them? Synthetic. Let me get the word right. Synthons.
I was pretty sure you called them equivalents.
Synthetic equivalents. Okay, I did. You're right. Better. Synthetic equivalents. Thank you, guys. Okay. So we got these two possible synthetic equivalents. But I have a problem with the one on the left. And that is, if I take these two molecules and I try to react them together, I don't get the expected reaction. Care to venture to guess what we get?
Do you deprotonate the hydroxyl group?
Absolutely. Acid-base reaction. The proton is acidic, and it grabs the proton, and I wind up making this guy, plus I wind up making just acetylene. And so you can't have an alcohol and an acidic proton at the same time that you're trying to react with a strong nucleophile or strong base like that. The two just aren't compatible. And so this doesn't work. So we need to come up with a different idea. And the idea that I like to look at is one of when you have an oxygen and a cation that are right next to each other, that this synthon, whatever this R group is, the synthon for this, the synthetic equivalent,
did they get snapped?
They did not. Okay. Thank you. The synthetic equivalent is the epoxide. And you can see it in the pattern if we label where the oxygen is connected and where the carbocation is, in that that oxygen can utilize its lone pairs and easily stretch over to become an epoxide. In the same way that I look at epoxides, any sort of carbocation that ends up at the base of a carbonyl like this, I think of the synthetic equivalent of that as being an aldehyde or a ketone. And so this pattern is when the carbocation and the oxygen are on the same carbon. and those are the synthetic equivalents. So that gets us away from having these acidic protons that we have to deal with, and we can still rebuild our carbon-carbon bond structure the way that we want without having acidic protons get in the way. So let's take this guy that we've mapped. Let's redraw that problem here and restart that retrosynthesis. So as I disconnect it, I'm going to disconnect into the two synthons. And from those two synthons, I'll propose the synthetic equivalents, which are the epoxide and the sodium acetylide. And now I've got to get that epoxide back to this alkyl halide. But that turns out to be easier than we think. So where do epoxides come from? So there's only one way that we know to make an epoxide, right?
MCPBA.
Yes. So MCPBA is that way. And that works from what functional group?
Alkene.
Yes. And then that alkene, we could envision being derived directly from the alkyl halide. So absolutely. So now we take it in the forwards direction. In the forwards direction, I need a reagent to be able to convert the secondary bromide into an alkene. So what reagent is going to allow me to perform that task? Thank you, JC. A bulky base is excellent. There are two. There's LDA and THF. There's more than two, but two main ones, LDA and THF, or potassium tert-butoxide in tertiary butanol are the two solvents that will accomplish that. And then from there, I need to make the epoxide. And we already said that that one was MCPBA. You'll see MCPBA written a couple of different ways. So maybe it's worth stopping just for a second, because I know Zaruba didn't cover MCPBA. And you'll see it written a couple of different ways. And I've seen people write it a couple of different ways. So this is meta. And when we use meta, instead of writing the word out meta, it's italicized M, lowercase, chloro, peroxy, benzoic acid. And so the MCPBA comes MCPBA from the initials. And many people will write it a lowercase m, capital C, P, B, A, or you'll see it written with a capital M most often as well. Either way is correct, and they imply the same thing. The reason for the lowercase m is to correspond to the location, meta location, which is italicized as a lowercase m for its locator position. And so you'll see it written both ways. And that's just a reagent of choice for doing epoxidations, because it's fairly stable. It works all the time, and it works better than most other reagents in terms of making an epoxide.
So
really common.
Jason, I was just going to ask about making an epoxide. Why can't you just use another like resonance stabilized carboxylic acid? I mean, you probably can, right?
You probably can, but the question then is, why is this chlorine here? What does the chlorine actually do? And what is the reaction mechanism? So when we look at the reaction mechanism, you know, the reaction looks like this. You got the double bond. You've got the oxygen that is bonding to it. We've got another oxygen, a carbonyl, the ring system, and then that metachlorine and the hydrogen that's here. And it's a paracyclic type of reaction. And so what winds up happening is electrons in this system flow this way, reaching out to grab the oxygen, this way into the bond, this way to make a new bond between the hydrogen and the oxygen. And then these electrons flow back in to rebond to the to what was the alkene. So all of that takes place. And what you end up with then is the epoxide. And you end up with a carboxylic acid, which is metachloro metachlorobenzoic acid. So what the chlorine does is the chlorine has tuned this electronically as an electron withdrawing group that has pulled electron density out of this, that makes this thing just perfect for doing this job. And so it's not the functional group per se, it's the entire molecule that is tuned in order to have this reaction happen. So if you think about what's going on in this reaction, even deeper than this, you have to think about it this way. And this is kind of a fun question to talk about, to answer. Okay, so this guy is acting as a nucleophile. This guy is acting as the electrophile. That means that the nucleophile is utilizing its highest electrons, its highest occupied molecular orbital electrons as its nucleophile. And it's transferring those electrons into the LUMO, the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital of the electrophile. And those orbitals are aligned such that the electrons will actually flow energetically. They're balanced so that the electrons flow to a more stable energy configuration. Otherwise, the reaction just doesn't go. So what is the chlorine actually doing? These orbitals can be tuned up or down. And what the chlorine has done is, through its electron withdrawing ability, has set these orbitals at just the right level in order to allow the electron flow to go in the direction that we need it to go. So any peroxy acid doesn't quite do it. I mean, it may do it to a degree, but it won't do it as well as metachloroperoxybenzoic acid. So that's just a little bit of reaction theory and kind of understanding why something is tuned and how we tune molecules. Molecules for reactions are tuned. I mean, some reactions just go, yes, but other reactions are very sensitive to electronics of the reagent that you're using. And the reagents, particularly the metal things, those things that use our transition metals, the ligands are chosen very carefully to tune the orbital energies to get them just right in order to do certain jobs. Change those ligands and things don't work out anymore. So that's an important component. All right, now I'm way far aside. Oh, we only have one more step to do here though. Okay, I'm gonna push this down a little bit so I can finish out our synthesis back here. This one, we react one with the sodium acetylide and two dilute acid. That will make our new bond. and protonate the oxygen once it opens up. So that is just an SN2 reaction hitting the least sterically hindered side of the epoxide. It takes the electrons with the oxygen. And then in the second step, we protonate the O- that resulted. Okay, so that's the first one that's there. And it gives us a lot of information. Number one, about this synthon and how this synthon is a synthon for an epoxide and recognizing this pattern. So what we're trying to see is that the pattern that we're recognizing is that when you want to clip a bond and the bond that you were clipping has a pattern with an oxygen, which is a 1-2 pattern, that pattern is an epoxide pattern. In terms of both the synthon and the synthetic equivalent. So that's the big lesson there. Okay, that takes us into the second page. And nine is only tricky in that we have one carbon source, but doesn't quite, let me skip to 10. We can come back and we can do 9. I want to stick with problems that the problem is well identified, and we'll come back. We can do 9 a little bit later. Let's do 10, 11, and maybe even 12. Okay, so the handle for this one is fairly simple. In looking at the handle, you get this big ring system. So with the aromatic ring system there, that makes it pretty darn easy. And when I have a ring system like that, I tend to do my numbering off of the ring system. Be careful, what a lot of people will do is they'll start numbering number one at the ring junction, and they'll number out 1, 2, 3, and then they'll number out 1, 2, 3 on the other side, and they won't see it as adding any carbons. And so sometimes you can make that mistake, but number off the ring and out the linear portion, and you'll see that what we've done is we've added one carbon. So that means that I need to tear that carbon off. And we need to think about how it is that we're going to tear that carbon off. If we tear that carbon off, we've got two possibilities, but really only one, which is going to work for us. Okay, so the synthons that I've drawn is I've drawn the ones that will more or less work. I'm going to draw the other ones over here because this is the other option. So the right-hand option, if we put the negative charge with the carbonyl and the positive charge with the CH3. This is not the normal easy way to do it, but it's the only way that we know to do it. This way is more common and much easier, but we don't know how to do it yet. What we don't know is we don't know if we react something with a negative charge and this carbonyl, the carbonyl breaks and becomes an oxygen, and then a single bonded oxygen, it becomes an alcohol. And then we need to find a way to reoxidize it back up to the ketone, and we don't know oxidizing agents yet. So because we've had no oxidizing agents, we haven't covered the carbonyl chapter. This way, which is actually really, really easy, is inaccessible to us. So we're stuck on the right-hand side. But the right-hand side is not so bad if we think about it creatively. The synthetic equivalents of the CH3 with the positive charge are just methyl bromide. But what is the synthetic equivalent of the negative charge and the carbonyl? Yeah, an alkyne anion. So what we'll do here is the synthetic equivalent of this guy is just that. Because we know how to take an alkyne and take it back to its carbonyl. We'll have to figure out the right reaction to take it back and put the carbonyl in the right place, but we know how to put that carbonyl there from a carbon-carbon triple bond. And so this is not a bad idea. This is actually pretty darn good. And then looking back at where we came from the dibromide, well, we can actually just take this directly back to the dibromide because through an elimination reaction, we can get there from an E2. And so this problem is not nearly as hard as it looks. So let's write it out in the forward way, and then you give me some reagents in order to accomplish this. Oh, I know, there was something else I was going to talk about here. I'll show you in a minute. Let's take it in the forwards direction and then I'll show you what I mean. Forwards. I need a reagent to convert this guy into that guy. How do I do it? That'll work. Okay, so JC, you're giving me a sequence, which I like. All right, let me highlight the difference between JC's sequence and what I was proposing here, which is where I wanted to go. So this is perfect. If I do one sodium amide and then two dilute acid, it would form what I want. But if I take the same starting material and instead of protonating it, leave it as the anion, and in a second step, react it with the electrophile, I could do one sodium amide and then capture the resulting anion with the methyl bromide. I never actually draw the anion, but I go through the anion in order to put the methyl group on it. The other way, if I were drawing it out, I would still have to do a deprotonation and then the methyl bromide. And so the bottom way is just cleaner, easier, better. And now from that, I need a reagent which is going to allow me to convert this to put the carbonyl on carbon number two. 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3. So I need to know how I'm going to get that carbonyl on carbon number two and what reagent will accomplish that. Stirling, nice. 9 BBN will do it. There are other boron reagents which are used more commonly for this than 9 BBN. But I have already, peroxide and water, I have always allowed for and gone for the 9 BBN. And then the oxidation, yes. And 9 BBN has two big alkyl groups on it. The more common reagent that's used for this is this reagent. It's even bulkier than 9 BBN. And I think it's called dithexyl borane. I have to look it back up. I can't remember the name of it.
Jason, it's more hindered than 9 BBN.
Sterling, you're breaking up a little bit. Try
that. It's also more selective, right? So it's going to... Cool. Sorry.
Correct.
Since it's larger than 9 BBN, that means it's probably more selective, right? It would up the yield of the product you want. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's also less expensive than 9 BBN. I think it's a cheaper alternative that's just also just really sterically bulky. See, 9 BBN, the thing about 9 BBN is that the actual molecule has the arms tied back. And because of the nature of the bicyclic ring system, there's no rotation. Whereas these guys have free rotation about their sigma bonds. And so they act like propellers and wings that make them even larger than they are just on their own because of the rotation about that. There's no rotation about these types of guys over here. And so the steric bulk of these big groups out here is really quite large. Okay. That's a good problem. Let's hit 11. 11 introduces an important idea. And if at any point you want me to stop and hit something else, or you've got a question, please. And I know that I had asked you guys to sort of like work on these before this session and come in with questions. The morning didn't have any. I just assumed the afternoon didn't either. I should have asked. I apologize.
Jason. JC asked in the chat about acid catalyzed hydration instead of hydroboration for number 10.
Okay, good. I'll move 11 down a page. We'll come back to it. We'll utilize this space to address that. Okay, if we were to take and do the acid catalyzed hydration, the first thing that's going to happen is the molecule reaches out and grabs the proton. And then we have the two options, right? So what we do is we look at the possibility that the proton goes to the terminal end, generating the carbocation in that position, or the opposite. It does not look like a positive charge. And so when we look at this, when we look at these two options, this one has resonance. The other one, no resonance. So when the water molecule comes in, its preferred direction is to go alpha to the aromatic ring system.
And that's because the carbo, so yeah, so like when you have a allylic carbocation, that's the one that's going to form because it has the better electronic preference. So if it was internal without like the allylic position to any resonance, then it would be 50-50. But since it's allylic to the benzene, the resonance makes that contribute more major.
Correct. Ah, it never wants to do what I want it to do. There we go. Okay, the difference is really that when we look at these two cations, the cation with resonance is lower energy than the one that has no resonance. And so what's happening is your energy here is determined, and that all of your reaction goes this direction through the lowest energy pathway. And Sterling, what you said is correct, that if it were secondary and no difference in electronics, so if this alkyne were internal and there was no difference on electronics on either side, I'd get a 50-50 mixture. But because this one does have a resonance donating group, the carbocation is stabilized alpha to that resonance donating group, as opposed to pushing it farther out next to the methyl. So that's exactly right. And so this one would continue to go on. This would get deprotonated. We'd have a deprotonation step. We would get the enol, and then that enol would tautomerize. So enols are always fleeting. And we would get the wrong substitution pattern. 1, 2, 3. Rather than what we wanted was the carbonyl on number 2, which is why we need to use 9-BBN, because 9-BBN then works on sterics. So when we look at the 9-BBN reaction, (9-BBN) selects to put the boron away from the large aromatic group. And what that does is take these two groups that are the largest groups and puts them away from each other. And that's why that selectivity works. Does that help, JC?
Yes, a lot. Thank you both.
Awesome. All right, let's pick up number 11. All right, so with number 11, the mapping and the handle aren't too bad. We've got the ring that maps out. But what's different about this one is that we don't have more carbons, we have less carbons. We lost a carbon. And in losing a carbon, we gained oxygen. And so we have to find a way to get rid of a carbon. And there's only so many reactions that we know that we can throw a carbon away, or that we can break a carbon-carbon bond. I mean, how many reactions do we know where we actually break things apart? Maybe two or three.
Ozonolysis, I think, is one.
Ozonolysis is a perfect one. So if we take this and we take it back to the alkene, then by ozonolysis, I can go back to that carbonyl. So this is called a functional group transformation. I'm converting the alkene into a ketone. And I can do it by ozonolysis. And we'll look at the exact conditions that I need in a minute. But then the question is, well, how did I get that alkene? My double bond's in the wrong position, so that's not helping me very much. So I need to go back to some intermediate. I need to go back to something that I can generate that alkene from. And that would be having some sort of leaving group here, either a bromide or a tosylate or something. But then that I can envision as having come directly from the double bond. And so this is going to give us a new tool that we can use. All right, so what we'll do, I'll ask you for the reagents. We take the endocyclic alkene, the endocyclic double bond, and we react it to form the tertiary bromide. So what reagent will allow me to do this? HBr. And I don't need peroxide, just straight up HBr is perfect. Then I want to eliminate. And I would like to get the double bond on the less substituted side. So what are we doing now? That'll work. Bulky base, two different bases will do the job. Potassium tert butoxide, or I could use LDA. Both will do that job. And then ozonolysis. And here, ozonolysis is always two steps. It's O3, and then either a reductive or oxidative workup. And in this case, a reductive workup or oxidative would work just fine. Zinc in water is the reductive workup. That's going to take and split that bond. And in splitting that bond, I'm going to break it apart into two molecules. And the other molecule is formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is a gas, and that gas simply leaves the reaction vessel and allows me to be able to isolate the molecule that I want. And so this illustrates the idea of throwing away a carbon, where sometimes I can throw away a carbon as opposed to having to always add carbon. Sometimes throwing away a carbon, adding extra and throwing something away can be extraordinarily helpful in some instances. They allow us to put some things together in ways that we may not have anticipated. I'm thinking about a problem that's not on the sheet. It uses some things that we learned today. Let's see how you guys do with this. First, I have to be able to draw it. Without giving the answer away, so give me a second. Gymnastics, mental gymnastics. I could easily draw it on the paper, but then if I draw it on the paper, then you see me draw it, so that doesn't work. Shoot. That's what I want to make. Yes, JC, I'll do 13 and 14. Absolutely. Those are ones that I want to hit too. And 16. I'd like to hit 16 because 16 is kind of the reverse of what I'm doing right now. Ooh, but I may only have time for 13 and 14. Okay. What did I do here? Hopefully I did it right.
You broke a ring.
I did. How did I break it?
Also through osmosis.
I did. How do I put it back together and figure out which way it goes back together?
On the aldehydes.
The aldehydes have to go back together, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just do it this way. One. One, two, three, four, five, six. One and six have to be connected together, right? With a double bond. And I think I put in an extra, damn it, did I?
Okay, that was tripping me out. I think you did put in an extra carbon.
I did, I put in extra carbon. All right, so one carbon needs to go away. That's what I was trying not to do, but okay, better. All right, so one and five need to connect back together. So as I connect those back together, we can envision a five-membered ring system, and then we just number out the ring system, one, two, three, four, and five. Two has the methyl group. And one and five have the double bond. So that means if I want to orient the molecule the same as what I have it on the left-hand side, then that means that I could just simply turn this thing around a little bit and say this is equal to, with that group up and the double bond there. And the numbering system still works. So this would be one, two, three, four, and five. And my handle in this problem is really the methyl. And so that methyl was allowing me to sort of orient everything and see where the problem was going. So that means then if I'm working retrosynthetically, I figured out how to break it Now what I need to do is I need to figure out how to migrate that double bond into that position. And this problem is the same as the last problem. I'm just migrating in a different way, right? So once you see that and you start to see that pattern, then what we do is we migrate to the bromide, and then that can go back to the starting material. And so in the forwards direction, this problem isn't any harder. What's harder is the mapping, but the problem itself is not any more difficult. Once you get it mapped out and once you find it in your head, everything's okay. So now forward. Again, you guys give me the reagents. I want to brominate. This time I want the bromine out that direction. HBr and peroxide, yes. From there, I would like to eliminate to produce the double bond in that location. Smaller base? Smaller base would actually pull the proton over here. So we have to be careful about that smaller base thing. The way it works in terms of smaller base versus bulky base, if I look at these two protons and I label the two protons as these guys is A and this guy is B, B has more sterics around it. In order to get to B, I need a small base. A large base can't access B very easily. So the bulky base is how I choose the less sterically hindered protons. Oh, on the methyl, yes, except there's no leaving group with the methyl. So if you look at the methyl, there's nothing alpha to the methyl to leave. The leaving group is out here. So you can't pull the proton on the methyl because there's no leaving group on the tertiary center. So there's no competition with the methyl group. Does that make sense? So we'll go for the bulky base again. Potassium tert-butoxide. And then from there, ozonolysis and a reductive workup. That splits the bond here and gives me aldehydes in each position. And when I draw these products, I try to draw them in the exact same orientation. Sometimes that may cause me to have to lengthen a bond beyond what it would normally look like. And the molecule looks a little bit funky, but it's easier to keep the molecule shape in your mind because you haven't turned anything around. So keeping everything lined up in the exact same orientation is good. And if you want to match it with what we had up above, then we just use the numbering. So it's easier just to come in and say, right, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, or I think, actually I didn't number that one 1, I numbered this one 1, and this guy was my handle on which I focused everything. There we go. Okay, 12 and 13. 12 and 13 require a new skill set, a new idea. Give me 1 second. My iPad has decided to, for whatever reason, darken. That's better. Okay, so the new piece of information that we need is that when you have an epoxide and you treat an epoxide with a bulky base like LDA or potassium tributoxide, what can happen is the same sort of eliminations that we would typically think that these bases would cause. And so the base being a bulky base, let's actually draw a bulky base in here. These guys are non-nucleophilic. And being non-nucleophilic, they just simply won't act as nucleophiles and attack even that primary position, just because they tend to function as bases more than they do nucleophiles. They're just not good nucleophiles. And so what they do is they prefer to pull a proton. You pull a proton and you cause an E2 reaction. It's an elimination reaction. And in that elimination reaction, what we produce is an oxygen nucleophile. And it has a very particular pattern to it. 1, 2, 3. It is, if we call this I was trying to come up with a name for it, but it's not vinyl. Is it vinyl? It's not vinyl. It's it is beta to the double bond. And so if we look at that 1, 2, 3 pattern, where we get oxygen on 1, double bond between 2 and 3, this is the pattern that gives us this oxygen nucleophile. And then we can always take this and react it with something with an appropriate leaving group on it to do an SN2 reaction to substitute it, to make some sort of ether out of it.
So carbon 1 on your product, yep, side, is, when you say, we're saying it was beta to the double bond, is it also allylic?
I don't really know allylic, what beta means. That's what I was trying to come up with, allylic. So it's okay. Allylic to the double bond.
What does beta mean, though?
Alpha and beta are ways of referring to positions as well. Alpha on the double bond, beta adjacent to it.
Gotcha. So they're basically synonymous to, yeah. Gotcha.
So this is an allylic alkoxide. And so when we look at number 12, that's the pattern that we're seeing in number 12. And this is the helpful tip that really gets us through number 12. The rest of number 12 is pretty easy. So if we take this and then we recognize that in the product, what we have is that allylic alkoxide pattern. We can recognize number 1, the handle that we're kind of looking through there. We can number through our carbons, 1, 2, 3, and 4, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the bond that I'm going to do, these guys, all of this is new, but so is the double bond between 2 and 3. And so the pattern here that you're looking for is this allylic alkoxide, and that can come from an epoxide. And so what we'll do is we can break here retrosynthesis wise, taking it back to that guy and some appropriate bromide leaving group. This guy came from the epoxide and elimination on the epoxide. And then the problem, we're back into standard sort of problems that we've dealt with. This guy then came from the alkene, and that alkene came from the bromide. And so if you look at the tips, that sheet that I had good tips for doing these types of problems, this is something, this pattern that I highlighted in that sheet. But if you didn't look at the sheet or you didn't look at those patterns, then this problem becomes very difficult because it's hard to see how this could have come from the epoxide through an elimination. But now taking this in the forward direction, now that we've seen this chemistry, the forward direction isn't so bad. So forwards, I would like to eliminate and produce the alkene. And I'm almost hesitant here because I use a bulky base so often that I really should pick some more problems where I use small bases. No, just stick with the bulky. Just always go bulky. So the bulky base here, potassium tributoxide. Get the double bond, make the epoxide. MCPBA for the epoxide. After you get the epoxide, do the elimination. Again, this is either LDA or potassium tributoxide. LDA is a good one here because you want a really strong base that's really bulky. That is going to selectively pull this proton. So the base, it's going to grab that guy, push open. That's going to give you your carbon framework that you're looking for. And I would really say do that one, and then two, react it with ethyl bromide. No, always potassium tributoxide.
Wait, I have a quick question. Yeah. With a proton in that position, isn't LDA kind of bulky to like sterically hindered to grab that?
Oh, that's a great question. JC, find me a different proton.
On the either of the other connecting carbons or on that other, or if we number them, I could point them out.
Yeah, that's what I'm about to do. So I'll give you these protons here, this proton here. I've got a proton here, and I've got two here. So we've got A, B. Call this guy C and these guys D. All right, so now my molecule is a little cluttered, but let's take that molecule and just explore the different possible outcomes. All right, so when I do this, what I do is minus HA first. So I'm going to take my base and pull an HA. I can't push that negative charge in and have a leaving group leave because there's no leaving group. With HB, if I pull HB, my base comes in, I pull HB, I push in, I kick out. I have a leaving group. If I go for HC, minus HB minus HC, base comes in, pulls the proton, electrons go back in, but there's no place for them to go. The electrons are just sort of stuck there as an anion. There's no leaving group again. There's no way to push anything out. And it looks like, well, maybe I could push it in and push this out, but the orbitals don't align. The orbitals need to remember that what happens in an E2 reaction, oh, this is such good stuff. In an E2 reaction, when you pull the proton, you're pulling the proton anti-periplanar to the leaving group. Anti-periplanar because what's happening is that when you pull this sigma bond, what happens is you have the antibonding orbital, which is green and yellow. And the antibonding orbital for the leaving group is here. That's the sigma star bond. And this other bond is the sigma bond. These guys are of like charge. So when the base comes in and pulls that proton, electron density is dumped into the sigma star bond, which pushes out the leaving group. And they must be anti-periplanar. They must be 180 degrees to each other. Otherwise, the reaction doesn't happen. Otherwise, there is no E2. So E2 had a restriction that it must be anti-periplanar. And if we look at the bond angles that are happening in here when we pull HC, HC is not anti-periplanar to the leaving group on the other side. And in fact, if we go through and we sort of look at it and we do a Newman projection, we can Newman project that. Now you've got me going. So that I've got the hydrogen, the epoxide must come back into the bond. Out here, I've got the isopropyl group, and then eclipsed because of the conformation of an epoxide, eclipsed are the hydrogens. And so if I pull this proton, it is not anti-periplanar to anything and can't dump its electron density in order to kick out the leaving group. Is this ringing bells in terms of E2 reactions and orbitals and orientations and Newman projections and all kinds of crazy things? Okay, so what happens here is there's no leaving group again. And then the last one has the exact same problem. So if I pull HD, and the base comes in and pulls it. This is why I'm giving this its due energy, because it was a really good question, JC. And it's not obvious. And so taking the time to go through these possibilities to show what really happens was important. Same problem. Which means that out of all of this, there's only one proton that can possibly be pulled. And so if there's only one proton, it doesn't matter how sterically bulky it is, it will find it and pull it. It may take longer, but if there's only one, it's like this. I imagine reactions like this. This is how I think of them. This is a bucket full of water. This is a tiny hole. This is your chemical reaction and the drips of water coming out of this bucket. The reaction may be slow, but eventually all the water will go through that hole because it's the only place for the water to go.
Is there like a reason you wouldn't want to use a small base for this?
For this one, it doesn't matter. But Yes, actually, no, I take that back. There is a reason, JC, and that's another good question. The reason is that a small base, if we were to take a small base and try this with a small base, say sodium ethoxide, the ethoxide is a nucleophile. And so we would do 1 and 2 dilute acid, and it would protonate this, and we would get the alcohol. And the bulky base are not nucleophiles. They're non-nucleophilic. Their sole job is really to pull protons. They're so bulky that they don't act as nucleophiles easily, but they will pull protons. But if you go for a small base, the small base can be nucleophilic. And so these epoxides, especially with primary positions, are strong electrophiles and will react with those nucleophiles to do substitution, to do SN2 reactions. And so we can't rely on them to pull a proton all the time. I got my 5-minute warning. This was such a good discussion though. You guys have really, I'm enjoying the energy and the questions. Okay, number 13 is...
Wait, go ahead. Sorry about that. I said a question about when you break the, or when you're going back and deciding where you think it'd be best for it to break in terms of the oxygen.
Yeah.
Couldn't you break it the other way so that the oxygen...
went with the ethoxide? Yeah, I think I could. So what you're asking is you're asking, when I broke it, could I consider my disconnect to be, instead of what I did this disconnect. You're asking me, can I do this disconnect?
Yeah, it just reminded me of that one, like lithium with the hydrocarbon.
Yeah. Okay, so what would happen is I would have to get the plus, and I have to get the minus over here. Doable. This synthon would be giving me a bromide or a tosylate. And the tosylate is feasible because the tosylate could be made from the epoxide. The bromide could be made from the epoxide as well. Both of these could come from the epoxide. So let me show you. We could take the epoxide. We could hit it with potassium tert-butoxide, open it up. Let's do 1 and then 2. Let's make it into dilute acid to make the alcohol. That alcohol, if I treat it with tosyl chloride and pyridine, can then be turned into a leaving group rather than a nucleophile. If I take that alcohol and I react that alcohol with PBr3, I can turn that alcohol into a bromide. And so both of these then become leaving groups, where I could turn that reaction around.
Okay.
So Dylan, well, that's a great question.
Once you get the alcohol, it kind of just feels silly not to just like deprotonate that and slap something else on there.
Yeah, because it's just a one less step. It's just an easier step. Sure. But absolutely, that's one of the things that I love about synthesis is that all of a sudden, synthesis is a tool for teaching all of the chemistry that we want to teach, because all of a sudden it's got your mind working in all these different directions and you're remembering all the reactions, and they stop becoming single reactions and they start becoming tools that you're just like, oh, I can reach for that. Oh, I can reach for that. And you're using so many different things all the time that you're, it's like when you go to the gym and if all you ever do is lift weights on a bench press, you're going to get big biceps, but you're not going to be any healthier. You're not going to be any better. Yeah, right. But if you go to the gym and you're doing pull-ups and push-ups and right? You're exercising every muscle that you can, and you're jumping in the pool, and you're doing all of these different exercises, cross training. All of a sudden, all the skill sets become stronger. And that's why I like synthesis. It's not even the jazz of synthesizing something. It's really just, it's just working every muscle in every possible direction. And that's why it's really fun. Okay, I have to run. This has been super fun. And I wish I had a little bit more time. And you guys have, if you've got great energy today, and I greatly applaud you and thank you for your efforts today. This is a fantastic class.
Could you send out an announcement just about the next test? When you have to go, so I just wanted to.
Oh, or when the first test is going to be? I will.
Just kind of. Sounds good. Cool.
Yeah. Bye, Jason. For planning purposes, I like to include all of this material that we're about to go through in the alcohol chapter, and then there's a little bit more material after that, and I like to have that test just before we start spectroscopy. So the test will break before we get to spectroscopy.
Killer.
Okay. Cool. But yeah, I'll put it out an announcement too. All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.